We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, December 17th, and a lot of breaking news this morning. First, Judge Mershon, remember him, you know, the judge in New York that just consistently wants to be in the headlines? Well, he has rejected Trump's request to dismiss the felony case. So this coming from the Washington Times. The judge Monday rejected President-elect Donald Trump's bid to have his hush money conviction dismissed because of the U.S. Supreme Court's recent ruling on presidential immunity. But the case's overall future remains unclear. Manhattan Judge Juan Mershon's decision eliminates one potential off-ramp from the case ahead of Trump's return to office next month, but his lawyers have raised other arguments for dismissal. Prosecutors have said there should be some accommodation for his upcoming presidency. Imagine asking just to accommodate a president. But they insist the conviction should stand. So this sets up a likely appeal, and I personally don't think that that ruling will stand, but it just goes to show how utterly biased this judge is to just continue to prolong this ridiculous case. And even the prosecutors just asking for an accommodation instead of recognizing, like, you lost, guys, you lost. But that will be very interesting, and Trump will have to continue to fight that. But we also saw yesterday just another horrible, horrible tragedy. And this is what I want to focus on for the first segment with our good friend Steve Dace from the Steve Dace Show on The Blaze. This is about the mass shooting at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison, Wisconsin yesterday. Several reports have come out. Obviously, the police haven't said a whole lot in terms of the shooter and what they know. They haven't confirmed the online rumored manifesto, but they have said that there was one teenager and one teacher who were killed, and then the 15-year-old shooter apparently turned the gun on herself. And it has been confirmed, at least through reports, that it was a 15-year-old female who, according to reporter Andy Ngo, who is one of our good friends, and he's a very good reporter, and a journalist, he posted a thread that you can follow on X that said that this particular teen girl who used the name Sam online did not identify as trans, which, of course, because this was so similar to the Nashville shooting, that was where a lot of people went. But it's really... So much can be said on this, but I want to welcome in Steve and get his thoughts on this, because Steve, you know, there are obviously so many responses to when things like this happen. But the thing, first of all, that struck me about this is that if this 15-year-old girl is in fact just, you know, not on any sort of hormones, not identifying as trans, all of this, I mean, in what world are we in, and what absolute depravity of culture are we in that now young females are starting to carry out these types of intentionally heinous crimes?
Well, Merry Christmas to your audience, Jenna, and good morning. And before we get into that, I want to say something. The last time I was on, I did not get a chance to say, and I wanted to say this to you in front of your audience, that for whatever my opinion is worth, I was just extremely impressed with the way you tried to maintain your integrity during the course of this entire election cycle, especially given the uniqueness of your situation and how you've been targeted as well for your past associations with the Trump administration, and for all the great things that Trump and his campaign did during this campaign, And we're grateful for that because we needed them to win it. One thing he did not do great was support the people that were dragged down into the lawfare with him, such as you. And I mean, I have seen people lose their integrity and get bitter and kind of spoil their witness for far less than what you have had to endure this year. And I just wanted to say, both to you and your audience, that, you know, for whatever my opinion is worth, that deserves a well done, good and faithful servant. And also credit to Tim and the team here at AFR that they stood with you and platformed you given those difficult circumstances, because I'm sure they were hearing from people also that someone had to be on the air here who was more of a blind Trump loyalist and would dare not have a contrarian take. So just really well done by all here, you and the network. And I just wanted to say that before we got into the conversation this morning to make sure I got it on the air this time.
Thank you, Steve. That I'm crying over here because that really means a lot to me. And I know that, you know, some more of the details that, you know, haven't been shared as publicly. And you and your family supported me and contributed to the legal fund. And for what it's worth, I really appreciate that. And I'm sorry that our last time, you know, our show, unfortunately, is only an hour. And so we had to cut you off at the very end. That's why we like to get you on at the front, so sometimes we can extend. So I appreciate you coming back on and sharing that. I didn't know actually that was the subject that we didn't get to. And so I greatly appreciate you and your friendship in saying that. Thank you.
You got it. So, and everybody's very welcome. As to your question, I am not going to rule out yet a trans connection. I'm well aware of Andy's work. He's done a lot of great work, but no human is infallible. Someone I know who is one of the board members at Moms for Liberty, lives in Wisconsin, has published some information that seems to indicate the opposite of that. So I think either way, well, number one, I think given the trend line we have seen with trans terrorism, I think we are probably just better off assuming that that is the case as a default until they prove otherwise. Especially because we just know authorities lie about this. Madison, Wisconsin is the most left-wing enclave in that entire state. Yesterday, a police spokesman went in front of a camera and said he could not confirm the gender of the shooter. So even, I mean, literally, you could just look at the shooter's dead body and confirm a gender, unless you're assuming that there are things that could be done to alter someone's gender, and therefore that you're buying into that premise, if you know what I'm trying to say. Okay. So I would just caution everybody hesitancy on where that's concerned, but it's really the same answer to your question, whether it is or not, because whether or not a teenage girl just acted without any chemical inducement into just complete nihilistic spiritual darkness at a Christian school right before Christmas, so the symbolism that goes along with that, or whether they felt a nihilistic darkness into taking these drugs that ought to be banned, and everybody that administers to children ought to face a tribunal where you're hung if convicted. It's the same darkness, Jenna. It's the same darkness. We're just retconning and following the trail of how it manifested itself, but it's the same darkness, and it is a grim reminder here as we approach the holidays, and we're still basking in the euphoria of this election, and this is the longest tenured time of consistent, no rake stepped on leadership that Trump has ever had. He even did a press conference yesterday, and he's just complete command of the agenda, of his tone. And I don't mean that in a wimpy church growth consultant manner, but a presidential one, of his rhetoric. He's giving our enemies nothing by which they could launch counterattacks against us and distract from the important issues of the day. I think we need to be reminded with another grim reminder of this tragedy. Evil does not sleep. It's not going to go away because we won one election. It's not. And this is going to require vigilance beyond the previous generation of, I come home from work, I watch Fox News all day, I vote Republican, and I saved America. I didn't get involved in anything civically. I just had this very passive citizenship that came down to when we consummated the relationship in the voting booth for however long the voting process took. That's like, well, I'm married. I'm only married when we're consummating the relationship. Well, that can only last for so long, man. What happens the rest of the days, times, and hours that you're married? I mean, the marriage is still happening. What are you doing? Same thing with your citizenship, right? When you're in that voting booth consummating the relationship there, that's just one act. So the rest of the time, what are you doing with your citizenship? Because the evil, the darkness is not going to go away until we make it.
So well said. And I think you're so right to focus on the fact that so many on the right that are very excited to go into 2025, and they should be, need to approach this with caution that this one election, well, there is a seismic shift and it is a win. It's not the permanent fix, that evil will continue to persist. And this tragedy is just yet another reminder of how we have completely excised God from our culture and from our society. I mean, this 15-year-old went to a Christian school and was still able to somehow get in the frame of mind to carry out this type of atrocity and clearly not have the respect for human life that shows the image of God in each and every one of us. And so, Steve, where do you see then the lines of, I guess, the battlefield being drawn as we head into 2025 the most with this, as you rightly call it on your show all the time, the spirit of the age?
I think that on a national level, as much as you can, Jenna, because so much of the country is balkanized. I mean, you talk about the direction, change of direction in this election. This is the first time since 1980 that every single state went more Republican, went further to the right than it did the previous election cycle. That had not happened since 1980. Trump was closer to winning New York than Kamala was to winning Florida. So you are seeing signs of normie America. How would I define normie America? People who just have some generic moral value system, aren't spirit-filled believers, could be rooted in, you know, what Abraham Lincoln used to call America's civil religion, the belief in the Ten Commandments and the Constitution. Now, a lot of people don't even know what's in the Ten Commandments or the Constitution anymore, but some kind of peripheral, you know, vague, ether-based understanding of those things, that there has to be some kind of common sense. We can't just have legislative insanity. There has to be some kind of accountability. We can't have a participation trophy culture, that kind of stuff. And we've been wondering, at least I have been the last few years, I mean, how much more were Democrats going to push us to the brink of nihilism here before whatever's left of normie America woke up to what's happening? And we just saw that we found out what that breaking point was. And on a political level, the Trump team faces now the opportunity that we've seen a couple of governors, mine, Kim Reynolds, but especially the more high-profile one is Ron DeSantis. And what they did is they governed so well, in both cases, they governed so well and so efficiently, and then successfully, that people got to see, oh, what they want to do isn't nuts. Oh, they're not Nazis. Oh, they're not racists. And they reduced the Democrats to having to just have a debate based on who's better on the issues and take away the rest of the sideshow, the ad hominems and the demagogueries. And in both of those states now, in Iowa where I live, in Florida, I think that's where you live with Ron DeSantis, the Democratic Party is nothing but a letterhead. It largely does not exist as an entity. And that's because people got to live true right of center governance to some varying degree, and it made sense to them, and it discredited all the Democratic talking points. And so those parties in those two states have to go back to the drawing board. He's got a chance to do that nationally with everything they've called him, they've done to him. If he goes in there and governs as efficiently as you can, being president's way harder than even being a governor. Way more events will happen to you cannot control. But if he does that for the most part efficiently, if he does that effectively, He's already put a huge dent in their talking points by all these long form podcast interviews that he did, that he's not a Nazi, he's not Hitler, he's not a racist, et cetera. If he can do that now for our policies, by and large, then on a national level, as you look down the Democratic bench and you're largely looking at people like Gretchen Whitmer and Gavin Newsom, neither people who didn't want to get involved in this campaign cycle, Josh Shapiro, it's not like there's a huge bench of people there that the public is clamoring for the next generation of Democratic leadership. He's got a chance to marginalize them multi-cycle the way Reagan did in the 80s. And this isn't on a political level. This is an opportunity that it, I hope that they see. I see evidence of optimism. They do with, again, how efficient he's been, how on message him and his entire team have been. There's just not out there the canards and the rakes to step on and the urination matches of his ego. I just don't see him falling into those pits right now. And I'm impressed. And the longer that can continue and he can govern somewhat efficiently and effectively, the more marginalized Democrats will be nationwide. But on a spiritual level, that opportunity then opens up one for us on our end. And the long-term battle here is going to have to come from the church. The church must reassert its place of prominence within this culture. And I don't know that how many more opportunities like this we are going to get, where the spiritual manifestations of that we see in the political arena are set aside long enough that the church is now has an opening to step forward into that breach and reassert itself as the spiritual, moral, ethical hub of America. And that, to me, I saw a great message that my buddy Jack Hibbs put out just a couple days ago, and I shared that, where he is speaking directly to that, to the church. This last election has a chance, and in the cold civil war that we're in right now in this country, this last election has a chance to be our Gettysburg. And I mean, they threw everything at us in this round, in this last round of culture war. They did the culture war equivalent of Pickett's charge. They threw everything at us, and we beat them. Okay, but here's the thing: there were still two more years between Gettysburg and Appomattox. So the war is not close to over. So this is either going to be a commercial break where we didn't take advantage of the pause and we're going to regret it generationally moving forward, or it's going to be a Gettysburg moment. We'll look back on this in 5 or 10 years and say, hey, this was the moment that we didn't become the UK, where if you're upset in the UK, your vote is irrelevant. You have the Mitt Romney party versus the Ocasio-Cortez party. And no one cares about you there. And it's do you like, Marxism through corporatism, or do you just like it just straight up Soviet mainlined into your veins? That's the debate there. All right. And that will be what will happen here if we do not take advantage of this moment here on both the political and spiritual tracks.
We absolutely have to. And I love what you said about Pastor Jack Hibbs' message. I listened to that as well. And we're hoping to have him on this week to expand on that more. But you're right that the church has to use this moment to engage. And it's almost ironic. And I've thought of it this way, Steve, that as Breitbart very famously said, that politics is downstream from culture. Maybe in 2025, we can use the political shift to actually then impact culture and kind of go backwards in that sense, and kind of
can
go
I address that
upstream.
Really quick? Do we have time?
Yeah,
do we have time
absolutely.
To address that really quick?
Yep.
Andrew Breitbart is correct about that, but I don't think he's correct necessarily for the reasons he saw at the time. On the right, politics flows downstream from culture because our politicians they suck most of the time. And so we have to do like 50 years of terraforming on the life issue to get them to finally craft legislation that would push back on Roe. What you saw in Florida was the opposite, where the governor was way more right and based than the culture. And then he moved the culture to the right because of his leadership. See, on the left, politics does not flow downstream from culture on the left. On the left, what happens is they decide on a policy level that you can't get elected dog catcher without being willing to do a gay marriage yourself. And then suddenly every movie they produce in Hollywood has a homo character in every single one. Okay. And on the left, they lead. And so on the left, culture flows downstream from politics. On the right, politics must flow downstream from culture because most of our politicians are feckless or just flat out quislings. And this, at this point, you're correct about Trump. He has a chance in the macro. Now, the gains won't be as stark as what we've seen in my state of Iowa or your state of Florida with DeSantis, because again, too much of the country is balkanized and gone, and it's a hard job. And let's face it, much of this Congress is terrible, R or D. But if he can do that, we saw in the 80s, Reagan led, okay, and all of a sudden it became cool to be successful. It became cool to be a patriot. We saw this in the movies you and I watched growing up as kids in the 80s, all right? And the same thing can happen here. If he leads and is successful, the culture will follow suit. You've already seen major corporations canceling their DEI marketing and advertising after this last election. So what builds culture is always the same thing, leadership. There's more leadership on the left. And that's why on the left, culture flows downstream from politics. There's less leadership on the right. And that's why politics flows downstream from culture.
Really well said. And I couldn't agree more. And I think that we need to ensure that we do take this moment in time for the church to rise up and reestablish a Christian nation, not in a Christian nationalist sense, like a lot of those people want to just impose a Christian view on everyone and force them to believe. There's a very fine difference, and we have a lot of shows on that, and that could take another hour to explain. But to reestablish morality and to stand up firmly for the gospel of Christ, especially in this season. So, Steve, again, really appreciate it, and I so appreciate your friendship and support. Thank you again for your kind words and just public validation of me this morning. It's been a lot, but we're going to be moving forward into next year. We'll be right back with more. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And if you have been following this crazy drone situation, there have now been reports that there are drones over a military installation in Utah. There have been a few other sightings. And yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the FAA, and the Department of Defense released a joint statement on the drone situation. And this is pretty long, but you can obviously go and read that. And it's been reposted a lot on X. But basically, they said, and I'll just summarize this, that there are more than 1 million drones lawfully registered with the FAA in the United States, thousands of commercial, hobbyist, and law enforcement drones in the sky on any given day. Having closely examined the technical data and tips, we assess that the sightings to date include a combination of lawful commercial drones, hobbyist drones, and law enforcement drones, and we have not identified anything and do not that assesses the activity to date to present a national security or public safety risk over the civilian airspace in New Jersey. So do we believe this? So joining me now is our friend Scott Uhlinger, who is a former intelligence agent. And Scott, you know, I feel like if we had a little bit more faith and trust in government, these particular institutions, and especially the Biden administration, we may take this on face value and go, oh, okay, they've actually investigated this. But I'm not really inclined to just go, okay, you know, let's move on.
No, you're exactly right. I'm very skeptical of anything the government is saying. President Trump has stated that, I think maybe he received a briefing, but he had stated that they know exactly who, what it is. And everything indicates that this is in fact, the U.S. government. In fact, they wrote statements basically are at this point. The idea is that it's an Iran, which is ridiculous, or China, which is more possible, I guess, have been rejected. So I think, having looked at everything, I think I've come to the conclusion that it's one of two things. It's, first of all, it could be a government psychological operation. In other words, they create these sightings as a test of our response or a distraction of some kind. I think that that's a possibility. The other possibility is that perhaps there is massive training going on in the military because our supply of drones far exceeds our supply of drone pilots. And so we need massive training. And so the idea that they're using populated areas as training grounds makes a certain amount of sense if they believe that there's some kind of conflict ahead and they need to train drone pilots in realistic scenarios. At the same time, they don't want to admit to any foreign power that the United States is kind of behind the eight ball and that the United States needs to conduct a lot of drills to enhance its capability.
Those are both fascinating scenarios. And, you know, we've heard some of the other theories posited, like Iran and China, and then also that this is somehow the bringing over and populating the United States with the Ukraine nuclear warheads. I've seen a few of those commentators on social media. Why are you eliminating those as maybe your more likely possibilities?
Well, right. The nuke thing has to do with there's one specific website that that looks at radiation counts in the New York City area and holds that Manhattan Island is showing right now a large amount of radiation exposure compared to everywhere else, which leads people to believe that there is some kind of nuclear component and that the that the drones are some kind of are sniffers, are looking for, are trying to identify a source of radiation. I mean, that, I guess that's possible, but the point is that at this point, there are, as you pointed out, there are drones over Utah. There are now drones reported in D.C. And so I think the wider the presence, and the government even admitting that it's a combination of privately owned drones, because it's like basically people who want to play along, and government drones, tends to indicate, because of the widespread nature of it, that it maybe is some kind of psyop. And like I said, the other possibility is also now apparently Scott Adams, who used to be the Dilbert cartoonist, has some observations, and I've always trusted his observations as somebody who has a different point of view. I guess he pointed out that, and I don't know if this is true, that the drones are basically quitting at 11 p.m. at night, that they're not flying at all hours. And so if they are indeed quitting at 11 p.m. every night, it tends to indicate that it's some kind of a pattern. Like, in other words, it's military training of some type that happens after dark, but ends at 11 p.m., so it's very hard. This is a perfect example of how it's very hard to sort out the reality of the situation. And a person has to look at multiple reports and multiple sources of information to try to determine what the truth is. And so I've done that, but this indicates the difficulty in doing that because I am not sure of my theories.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Scott Uhlinger, who is a former intelligence agent, and the idea that this may be a PSYOP or training. Training would seem to make a lot of sense, and for the rationale that you suggested why the government couldn't admit that makes sense. But even a PSYOP just in terms of conditioning the response, because we are living in a very different multimedia situation than we have for other types of warfare. And that also raises kind of a red herring that it's fascinating to me that we don't have more images and all of that coming out of the Ukraine conflict, by the way. But there are all kinds of questions, and there are all kinds of things that are raised on especially social media, because people have the ability to record anything anywhere and then post it and share it publicly. So we don't have these type of media gatekeepers that we used to. And so, you know, my personal opinion of the entire COVID scenario was that at least one of the objectives was a conditioning of public response for the government to just say, well, if there is a widespread emergency, especially if it's in the area of public health, then we want to see how many people will go along with our solution and how we can massively persuade them. And so in that sense, if it's a PSYOP on that kind of level, what would that potentially look like? I mean, what would this be preparing the masses for?
Right. That's a very good question, because then I think you really nailed it when you talk about the COVID vaccine, because certainly that was definitely one of the missions of COVID, which I was a skeptic of from the beginning. I never got the shot, neither did my family.
Same.
Is that they were trying to program a response and wanted to see what the level of obedience is. So, right. So what would this be possibly preparing for? Potential war in the future where drones are going to be a key part, because we know that is the case. If there is another war, that drones are going to be a key part of that war. Someone else had mentioned that there apparently is some FAA legislation that's on the docket that, and the FAA legislation basically is greatly restricting the amount of drones that can be available to the private sector that citizens can own. And so some people have said that, and this again makes some logical sense, that that what they want to do with the PSYOP is teach people to be fearful of drones, and that way perhaps allow easier passage of the FAA legislation, which will restrict private ownership of drones. Because you have to look at it as far as warfare goes, drones actually favor the insurgents, so to speak. Because in other words, you know, a normal power has air power, tactical aircraft, etc. But if you're in a scenario where there was a rebellion of some kind in any country, that the rebel forces, which of course would have fewer resources, would be able to use drones to offset the superiority of who they were rioting against or who they were rebelling against. And so this, some people have said that this is the kind of turn off Americans to the idea of drones, so that perhaps, like in the way, the same way that sometimes the government wants to discourage private gun ownership for the same kind of reasons that we just saw even yesterday with the school shooting. So in other words, get the Americans to dislike the Second Amendment, get the Americans to dislike the idea of drones. This law will reinforce it and will intimidate people or frighten people into accepting this law, which will then actually restrict their own access to drones in the future.
Wow. And that kind of setup, I would absolutely believe not only is possible, but is likely. I mean, I've seen things happen in terms of that kind of strategizing and the play out to try to get people to be complicit in their own deprivation of rights, which is what you're talking about, which is why
right.
We need to always remain vigilant. And it's interesting that you raise this when we just saw yesterday the horrific mass shooting in Wisconsin, and that will always raise the question to the left immediately of gun control, the Second Amendment. And so that's being weaved into the narrative. Now, whether those events are necessarily coordinated, the timing is certainly suspicious. And the media always, the left-wing media that is working in tandem with this type of PSYOP, if it is, will always take those opportunities to position the masses to think how they want. And so what would be your advice to people listening on, because, you know, we don't want the response then to go massively to the other side where we believe all kinds of conspiracy theories, or we're just totally skeptical that, you know, we don't participate in regular civil society. What should we do as a response to be aware of these types of things and stand firm for our rights, particularly the Second Amendment, to be protected?
Well, I guess the answer is kind of what happened during the COVID outbreak, quote unquote, and that would be to just remain calm and remain determined to do what you think is right. There's a lot of hysteria surrounding this. There certainly was a lot of hysteria surrounding COVID. But I stuck to my guns, and I ask Americans to stick to their guns as far as this and be aware of any legislation that's coming down the pike that would try to restrict people's access to drones, because that will be the key to determine if this theory is correct. If it's correct, then they will try to introduce legislation to restrict drone ownership. And so that's something to be aware of. And then if people do see that happening, then that is proof positive that this was in fact a psyop designed to affect public opinion.
Well, I'm ready after this conversation to go out and get a drone just to make sure I have one before,
right,
you know, the access is cut off. I mean, yeah, and this is why in situations like this, we see a rise in, for example, firearm sales or things, or people saying, you know, we need to be able to have the right of self-defense if our own government turns against us. And that is a valid position to take. I mean, this is exactly why, for a variety of reasons, but this was one of the reasons that our First Amendment, or our Second Amendment, rather, was enshrined into our Bill of Rights, to ensure that not only do we have a right of self-defense as individuals, but that we can have access to the continuing technology. And so for people who just say, oh, well, the Second Amendment is about, you know, the long, just, you know, single shot muskets that they had during the Revolutionary War, that's absolutely ridiculous. Of course, it covers continuing technology, which now includes drones. So, Scott Uhlinger, that's a really fascinating assessment. I'm so glad you joined this morning, and it makes sense to me. So we'll continue to follow this story. Appreciate Scott Uhlinger, former intelligence agent, and we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And Trump has already been negotiating a better America before he even takes office. This is exactly what you want out of a leader, by the way. I mean, the dude that is still supposedly in the White House is not doing anything. If anything, he's actually making America worse by selling off some of the border wall materials for like pennies on the dollar, which Trump said yesterday and called for him to stop doing, and just says, you know, he's undermining America before Trump can get back into office. And Trump rightly said this isn't a Democrat or a Republican issue. It's common sense. So he's at least doing, Trump is at least doing what he can before he takes office. And so this was just a great story about how he's already trying to boost the economy. And so Trump and the SoftBank CEO announced $100 billion investment into U.S. technological projects. It's coming from the Wall Street Journal. Donald Trump and SoftBank Group CEO jointly announced Monday that SoftBank plans to invest at least $100 billion in U.S. projects over the next 4 years, as the president-elect seeks to project enthusiasm over his return to power. And if you watch this, well, and also the Japanese internet and telecommunications company estimates that the U.S.-based investment will create 100,000 jobs at least, focused on artificial intelligence and emerging technologies and plans, which is very important. And we've been talking about a lot on this program that the U.S. needs to get up to speed with, especially AI technology. But if you watched this this press conference with the SoftBank CEO. It was amazing. And I was actually talking to my friend Dinesh D'Souza yesterday, and he asked me if I'd watched this video, and I hadn't at the time. So I went back and I watched it because he was saying how incredible it is that Trump was standing there with this CEO and asked him, and he just said, I'm going to ask him right now, like in front of all the cameras, would you make it $200 billion instead of $100 billion? Would you do that? And the CEO is like kind of laughing, and he says, well, I'll try to make it happen. Then he goes, he's a great negotiator. And so it was kind of a live moment of the art of the deal. And you just love that about Trump. And I think he is not just projecting enthusiasm over the economy. He's already getting some things done. So let's welcome in Tho Bishop, who is a content director of the Mises Institute. And Tho, what did you make of this story?
Yeah, well, I thought back to after his election in 2016, where he had a major deal with Carrier. Then as well, and this is something that Trump has the record of. It is plenty of the theatrical nature of it with the press conferences and also dynamic. I mean, this is very much the way that Donald Trump as president likes to handle deals like this. This projection going in with positivity, a big contrast to particularly economic performance of the last 4 years, and so week after ringing in the New York Stock Exchange, I wouldn't surprise me at all if we end up seeing a few more things like this. And I know that a big focus of Trump's economic agenda, as it was the first time around, is getting international investment going into the United States. This is part of his rhetoric on tariffs. This is part of a number of his key economic priorities that he ran on during his campaign. And again, I'm not surprised to see some stuff already coming through.
Yeah, and you're right to talk about the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, that was a pivotal moment as well. And when he was signing the book, apparently, wasn't he the first president since Reagan to actually be at the New York Stock Exchange floor?
Yes, he was.
Yeah, that's incredible. And, you know, to go and already be doing these things, I mean, he's acting more as the president elect than Joe Biden is right now. And that contrast is such an incredible just moment, I think, for America to recognize that this election of Trump, I mean, you know, like him or not, he is actually focusing on doing the work for America instead of even Republicans in the past that you kind of didn't know, you know, exactly what they're doing day to day. And you kind of wonder, OK, are they really working on behalf of Americans? I think personally, I'm speaking with Tho Bishop, who's the content director of the Mises Institute, that, you know, a lot of this is because Trump is the first person to come into office in American history, but especially in modern history, that his own brand was more valuable than the White House brand. And he didn't actually need to do this. I mean, he took a step down. I said that in 2016 before I worked for him. I said that all the time while I worked for him. And I will say this now, that, you know, I do believe he's genuinely wanting to work on behalf of America and America First, because he's a businessman and his own success is dependent on America's success. And so that translates to wanting a better economy. And so for things like this that he's doing ahead of time, before even January 20th, though, what practical things can and should he be doing on day one when he actually gets back into the Oval Office for the economy?
Well, there's going to be a number of fronts there, and I think one of the interesting things is he is inheriting an economy in 2024 than he was in 2016. It's also an extremely different world in 2024 than it was in 2016. I think one of the reasons, an advantage he has, particularly this time around, particularly in trying to appeal to multinational companies that could, you know, in theory, invest in a basis, right? There's some unique advantages to America in terms of workforce, there's other assets there for higher level jobs like SoftBank. Is that you have the rest of the world
the confidence crisis that we had, that America had, losing faith in the Biden administration, is not that lack of faith in leadership is not unique to the United States right now. You just saw the German government fell. There is a lot of political unrest throughout Europe. I mean, France is has had similar problems in Canada. Obviously, Trudeau's regime is in the tank down there. And so on the global stage, Trump, I think, from day one, is immediately in that leadership role, in part because of his past history. Where first time around, there was a little bit of skepticism, how is this going to work? There had not been a president like that. And so I think that's going to be a very different dynamic interest to the global sphere. Now, in terms of the domestic sphere, he's got more challenges than he inherited in 2016 for a number of reasons. And the biggest thing is that, we can talk about early stage things when it comes to deregulation, when it comes to executive orders dealing with domestic energy, when it comes to a variety of aspects that, I've no doubt you're going to see the big, you're going to see a number of major executive orders from day one. You're going to see a big goal list for the first 100 days. There's going to be a lot of energy. But ultimately, the true success of Donald Trump's next 4 years is going to come down to the Department of Government Efficiency, it's come down to spending. Because if there's one major measure, I think, that will dictate how things are going to be seen for years, the ability for Americans to afford a house is going to be the interest rate side of things, the ability to finance a purchase like that. And it's been the biggest thing that will move that is the ability to reduce the spending side of it. And that's the most difficult challenge. So there's a lot of things that I expect to happen in the short term, which will probably be in the positives. But also the biggest one is going to be trying to overcome systemic nature of decades and decades of the government spending. And that is going to be the biggest challenge. A lot of assets that no president had on the richest man in the world as your biggest advocate there. An incredible brain trust. I mean, the amount of talent he's coming in kind of dedicated to that one issue. There's a lot of reasons for positivity there. And to me, that is the one real measure on really, really getting the country back where it needs to be on the economic side of things, because spending is a national crisis right now.
Yeah, very well said. And I agree with you that that DOGE, at least in terms of exposing these priorities, has perhaps is the best positioned to do that and look forward to what they may accomplish. And one of the things that is new, and this was breaking late last night, is that Representative Thomas Massie, who listeners will know is the one who walks around all the time with the national debt live ticker that he created himself, that just shows and displays in real time how much the national debt is consistently going up. He has agreed to be part of DOGE, and I think that addition is going to be so great to have him and have him in Congress while working congruently with DOGE, hopefully on specifically the economic side, and to look at cutting all of the bloat and the ridiculous, outrageous spending. So just really quick in the last minute I have with you, though, did you hear about that with Thomas Massie, and what's your reaction to that? I love it.
And I mean, there's no member of Congress who is more serious on the spending side of things. Sometimes that get kind of in hot water in the past, his dedication to fiscal responsibility there. But I think that's great, and I think it goes into this much larger dynamic. I mean, the talent that's going into office budget management, and that's one thing is this is going to be a systemic problem. Congress is going to be the problem. When it first came around, we can talk about the spending that went up during the Trump administration. Most budgets that Trump administration wanted actually had some minor, I mean, they weren't major, but minor cuts of spending that the Trump administration proposed in their budgets to issue with Congress. And so that's going to be, the problem with wasteful spending is that some constituencies benefit from it. Those constituencies as members of Congress, that's often bipartisan in nature, so we're systemically broken in the way we handle budgets.
Yeah.
It's going to be a major, major effort. It's hopefully we can get done.
Yeah, well, as you said, I hope that, Congress and especially some rhinos in the conference who want big spending will be willing to participate in this, because that's part of, I believe, the Trump mandate going in. And that's part of what voters and what American citizens want. And so the people in Congress who are objecting to that, they need to get on board or perhaps be primaried. So, nobody should feel secure in Congress if they aren't willing to get on with a lot, get on board with a lot of these priorities. So, Tho Bishop, really appreciate it. And for listeners, I know his connection wasn't super great, and I apologize for that. We will work on that moving forward, but at least we got the gist of his brilliant analysis. And so I appreciate Tho Bishop's time. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.